Last week at this time, I was talking with my friend Greg LaBelle, Professor Emeritus of Political Management at George Washington University, about what this past week was likely to look like. Now it's behind us, and Greg LaBelle is back to examine what's taken place. Greg, welcome back to State of Belief Radio.
Thank you, Welton. Here we go again.
Well, a lot of analysts have begun to openly ridicule the Trump campaign's efforts to undermine the democratic process. Are you one of them?
Ridicule would not be the verb that I would choose. I am leery of their efforts. I think their efforts will fail. I continue to be disappointed in this candidate and this administration's willingness to continually challenge our democratic processes. That's sort of where I am, Welton.
A close result is close to the worst case scenario for many observers. What are your thoughts about that?
I think overall what we see is at least the potential for a rebuff of Donald Trump as president. What we do not see is a rebuff of Trumpism in this country. And that is of great concern to many of us, because as we look, particularly as we look down ballot, as we look at the results in some places, the continual almost 50-50 division of this country, Trumpism is alive and well. And regardless of the results of this presidential election, Trumpism will continue to be part of our lives, much to my regret.
Predictably, the administration's disdain for truth that has so corroded our public discourse has now taken on a life of its own, with partisans creating narratives out of random whole cloth, ballots stolen, ballots falsified, ballots uncounted. Regardless of the outcome, how in the world is anybody going to trust anybody else once this is over?
You have just said the magic word, Welton, and that is trust. The trust in this country has been so greatly damaged over the last 4 years, primarily by this administration, this president, that it becomes, I think, the greatest challenge that we face moving forward. Citizens don't trust their government. The government doesn't trust its citizens. The result is that we don't trust each other as citizens. This is a serious problem. However this whole thing ends up, I think the biggest challenge, and there are many challenges that a prospective President Biden will face, but one of the biggest ones it will definitely be, and one of the most enduring ones will be the erosion of trust in this country between and among all of us. And that's what we have to begin to focus on now. I hope we have the opportunity to begin to focus on that now. But it's going to be a long, hard haul to begin to repair the damage that's been done.
We can't know what will happen between the time we have this conversation and the time a listener hears it. With that in mind, though, could you talk about the anticipated dynamics between a President Biden and the kind of legislature we're currently seeing take shape?
Assuming that Joe Biden wins the presidency and is inaugurated on January 20th, he will face considerable challenges with a Senate that appears, and as you say, none of this is really resolved yet, but the possibility that he will face a Senate that is still in Republican hands, still in the hands of Mitch McConnell, the challenges that he faces will be significant. in moving his agenda forward. I'm sure McConnell and his folks are already making plans for how to thwart whatever efforts a new administration would undertake. I expect that a big part of the McConnell agenda will continue to be a transformation of the judicial system in this country, not just of the Supreme Court, but all the way down the line. I have no doubt that that will be continue to be a focus of theirs. I think if there is a glimmer of hope here, it is that Joe Biden and his 40 plus years in public office, most of which was spent in the United States Senate, makes him probably the president who is most comfortable with and familiar with and able to deal with the United States Senate since Lyndon Johnson. So there may be some hope there. There may be some vestiges of good relations, goodwill between a potential President Biden and members of the Senate. That remains to be seen. I think there is a glimmer of hope there, but it's only a glimmer at this point.
Greg, what, in your experience, and you've got a lot of it, what could be a promising tactic for trying to bring Americans, at least those Americans who aren't on the angry fringes, back together around a vision for the common good?
Well, I think we've begun to see that with how Vice President Biden has handled himself since Election Day, in that he is presenting himself in a very reasoned way. He is presenting himself, and he has made a point of saying, I actually like his quote. I ran for president as a Democrat. I will be a president of the American people. And this is quite a significant change from where we've been over the last 4 years. I think that kind of message is extremely important for a president to maintain. Certainly, how he proceeds with building his cabinet will send some messages to various people. But as I say that, I have to admit that doesn't sound like it's likely to be enough. And I think we really have to develop a means of some serious soul searching. We need to see some people on both sides of the aisle step up and say, we need to get beyond this. We need to find a way to come together. And it's going to have to be a collaborative and cooperative effort. I hope that there will be enough people who are fed up with what we have as a poor excuse for a national government at this time to move forward. But that is all purely speculative today.
You know, we saw the four Democratic freshman female members of Congress who came to national attention as the Squad all win re-election. A number of down-ticket races were won by members of marginalized groups. At the same time, Mitch McConnell, Lindsey Graham, and others targeted by the Democrats with huge amounts of money and effort won re-election with little trouble. Greg, are we seeing districts getting more and more polarized? And if so, why?
I think we are, and I think that it goes back a number of years. There have been a number of scholars who have written about this, and the increasing sort of self-selection that goes on in this country, where we find more and more people who think alike tend to seek each other out literally and end up living near each other. I mean, we have watched congressional districts on both, and this applies to both sides, become more and more homogenous over the last 20 years or so. That continues. That's part of the problem. This has to do in part with the way redistricting works in this country now. But it's also a sociological issue. There is this tendency on the part of Americans to move where near to where people who agree with them. And I this is, as I said, driven in part by the political decisions that are being made under redistricting. It has to do with the influence of social media. It has to do with a lot of things that, while not strictly speaking, are political, do have an interface with our political lives. And this is what makes this in part such a huge challenge. You mentioned the Squad and the fact that they were successful in winning, but we see also that a number of Republicans were able to down ballot, were able to pull off election victories. In my home state of New Hampshire, Democrats were fortunate and they managed to keep United States Senator Shaheen in place. The state electoral votes went to Biden. They maintained both of their Democratic members of the House of Representatives. But the state house, House of Representatives and Senate both switched from Democrat to Republican. So there are a lot of different sort of cross messages going on out there, cross currents that we have to try to figure out and deal with. But I think part of the challenge for Democrats now is there will be in the face of a non-existent blue wave. A serious, I'd like to say soul searching, but I think the better word is probably a battle between progressives and moderates, or however you want to define them, in terms of what we did wrong. And the battle will be serious, and it will take a lot of energy, and it will take a lot of time that I would frankly rather see spent figuring out how we pull ourselves back together as a nation.
What lessons should we all learn from how election night went? Again, recognizing that we don't know all of the fallout yet.
Win or lose, Donald Trump will continue to be the significant, the overriding power in the Republican Party, whether he is a second-term president or a former president. I think that will be the case. And I think he will continue to hold great sway over how that moves. Democrats have a more challenging problem in some ways, in that Democrats have been mismanaging some of their mindset and assumptions. And I think particularly about the disappointment that we have heard about in the so-called Hispanic vote. And that what I have just used as a term is a significant part of the problem in this country. There is no Hispanic vote in this country. There are many different Hispanic votes. And when we're talking about Cuban Americans in Florida, when we're talking about Mexican Americans in Arizona, when we're talking about South Americans who have relocated here, these are different groups with different concerns. I think the Democratic Party continues to treat them often as if they're sort of all the same thing. They have different issues. They have different things that matter to them. And we also see, well, and part of that is we sort of assume that if we're talking with Hispanic Americans, we need to be talking about immigration. And that's not true. There are issues, and we saw some of this in the exit polling. Hispanic Americans have some of the same concerns we do. Economic issues are as real for these groups as they are for other segments of the American population. But we need to figure out how to talk about those issues in ways that ring true with these different populations. So I think that I would say the same thing about particularly about African American men, and particularly young African American men. Exactly the same thing is going on there. Economic issues are significant for these groups, but we tend to sort of, Democrats tend to drop them into these overarching categories that don't make sense in the lives of the people we're talking about.
Think about this. You're in front of a classroom and you've got 2 minutes left or 1 minute left, and you say, I want you to never forget from this experience. I want you never to forget what I'm about to say. What would you say?
It's interesting because that is, in a sense, has when I'm teaching, has always been sort of the subtext of every course I have taught. And I will answer it maybe a little from a little different perspective, but I think it answers your question. One of the things, because my classes have always been like that, have always represented a wide variety of thought, of political belief, of experience, having had joint programs over the years with Native American students, with Hispanic students, students coming from the Hispanic Caucus, students who are coming from the Congressional Black Caucus Foundation. So I've always had very diverse classes. And I think the underlying theme has or approach in a classroom was always to model, if you will, and I'm almost sorry to use this term, but a safe space, a space where people felt comfortable to speak up and people were willing to listen and discuss. And I think that's a model that that I try to impart to students that they would carry away in their discussions in the future. A subset of that is something that I often said at the very beginning of my classes when I was talking about political discourse in this country. And it was, and there's a bit, I was going to say a bit of an oversimplification. I'm not sure that it is. And I would say that, that there was a time in this country when if you disagreed with me, you were wrong. Now it seems if you disagree with me, you're evil. And the difference between those two assumptions has much to do with where we are in this country now. And I lay a lot of the blame, quite frankly, on the rhetoric that we saw come out, have been around for a number of years, in the religious right. That difference between I think you're wrong and I think you're evil has led directly to some of the serious challenges that we face today. I hope that answered your question.
Greg LaBelle is Professor Emeritus of Political Management at George Washington University and the veteran of several presidential campaigns. He's held leadership positions at Interfaith Alliance, among his numerous other credits, and he continues to be a sought-after commentator on matters of politics, ethics, and the common good. Greg, I have to tell you, it's been a great honor and pleasure to be with you. Thank you again for being so generous with your time for State of Belief Radio, and I look forward to when we'll be together again.
Thank you, Welton. It's always an honor and a privilege to talk with you and to work with you. Thank you.